Book of Joshua, reading tonight at verse 14. Largely the story of Caleb. If you're 85 and over, this is especially for you. The young ones can just listen in then. Joshua 14. Now, these are the areas the Israelites received as an inheritance in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest, Joshua son of Nun, and the heads of the tribal clans of Israel allotted to them. Their inheritances were assigned by lot to the 9.5 tribes as the Lord had commanded through Moses. Moses had granted the 2.5 tribes their inheritance east of the Jordan, but had not granted the Levites an inheritance among the rest. For the sons of Joseph had become 2 tribes, Manasseh and Ephraim. The Levites received no share of the land, but only towns to live in, with pasture lands for their flocks and herds. So the Israelites divided the land just as the Lord had commanded Moses. Now the men of Judah approached Joshua at Gilgal. And Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, "You know what the Lord said to Moses, the man of God at Kadesh Barnea, about you and me. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to explore the land. And I brought him back a report according to my convictions. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. So on that day Moses swore to me, 'The land on which your feet have walked will be your inheritance and that of your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly.' Now then, just as the Lord promised, he has kept me alive for 45 years since the time he said this to Moses while Israel moved about in the desert. So here I am today, 85 years old. I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this hill country that the Lord promised me that day. You yourself heard then that the Anakites were there and their cities were large and fortified. But the Lord helping me, I will drive them out just as he said." Then Joshua blessed Caleb, son of Jephunneh, and gave him Hebron as his inheritance. So Hebron has belonged to Caleb, son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, ever since, because he followed the Lord, the God of Israel, wholeheartedly. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba, after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Anakites. Then the land had rest from war. This is the word of God. Please, Joshua 14. Let's read verse 11. "I am still as strong today as the day Moses sent me out. I'm just as vigorous to go out to battle now as I was then. Now give me this mountain." That's a better translation. "Give me this mountain that the Lord promised me that day." Are you one of those people who've really felt like giving up? You are tired. And to be quite honest, you feel tiredness. And it's that one of those tirednesses that sleep cannot cure. You're just, in the words of the Bible, weary in well-doing. You find life very, very difficult. And you really want to throw in the towel. You've been doing the same thing day in, day out for a long time. And now you're just at that place of absolute exhaustion. John McEnroe, in his autobiography called Serious, at the age of 30, wanted to throw in the towel. He had been hammered at the Australian Masters, 1-6. And he said that he would never play again. In fact, he stopped playing tennis for 6 months. And there he was one night with Tony Graham, another great tennis player, in his back porch in his Pacific Oceanside home in the USA. And him and Tony Graham went a walk along the shore, and John McEnroe said, "I think my bad form is a sign that I should give up tennis." And Tony Graham says, "Well, maybe you need another sign to start playing tennis again." Now, that night was a really high tide. And as they were walking along, a very big wave slowly came up the shore, and at his feet, in the wave, was a tennis ball. That is some story. Now, I don't know John McEnroe's spirituality, but I think that's a pretty good sign to take up tennis again. Maybe tonight's that tennis ball moment for you. And I don't know what's going on in the life of many of the folk here. I don't know what your story is. Maybe you're all like spring lambs, full of joy and really full of energy, and you can't wait to get going. Or maybe you can take some comfort from our friend Caleb here, 85 years of age. And there he was, he's got this vision, and he is saying, "Give me this mountain." Indeed, isn't that the title of one of Helen Rosevere's books, maybe her first book, "Give Me This Mountain"? By the way, pray for Helen. She's very, very ill just now. She's not expected to go on all that long. So what we have here is Caleb, this old man, and he's seeing something. What's his mountain? It's an area of difficulty. It's an area of tough life for him. It's something that's really, really difficult, but yet he has to conquer it for God. Let me give you a little bit more of a context here. We come to one of our favorite characters in the Bible, Caleb. And why is he a favorite character? He's a favorite character because he's one of us. He's not one of the big personalities in the church. He doesn't have an official position. He's not a prophet, a priest, a king. He's just an ordinary guy. And so he has got no office in the church. He is just a model of everyday, ordinary Christianity. And we see here, and the point is that in this ordinary track, he climbs up slowly. He is someone who really is just an ordinary person, and yet he's faithful to God. And so it's like a church like this. It's full of just ordinary people. We're not superstars or celebrities. We're just getting on with our lives. Fred Mitchell. I don't know if any of you know of Fred Mitchell. And that's, I suppose, the point. Fred Mitchell was the director of China Inland Mission. You've heard of Hudson Taylor, his mission. But nobody's ever heard of Fred Mitchell. He was a chemist. He was a pharmacist in Bradford, I think. And he was killed in an air crash flying from Singapore to London. The air crash, it was a comet, it crashed outside New Delhi, and Fred Mitchell was killed. And the thing about Fred Mitchell is that the last message in the plane, the last radio message as it was climbing was this: climbing on track. Fred Mitchell's widow wrote a book, and the title of that book is Climbing on Track. And so we find here, yes, it's easy to get on with God sometimes when it's going well. It's easy getting on with God when it's jazzy and when it's exciting. But here we have a lesson in Caleb of moving on with God with a humdrum routine of life, just climbing steadily. And so we've got here an encouragement to us all to be climbers. Well, Joshua, of course, the eponymous writer of this book, was the military strategist. He was the guy with the energy. He was the big name. But then we've got our friend Caleb. Now, what we have here, there were still some territories, there were still some dangers. And this is a stress that we've had in Joshua again and again. And the point is, we never arrive. Remember, the old folk used to talk about the three tenses of salvation. You go to Keswick Convention, and a lot of speakers would talk about the three tenses of salvation. We have been saved from the penalty of sin. We are being saved from the power of sin. We will be saved from the presence of sin. So we've not arrived. For Caleb, there was rescue, but there are still more battles. In Jesus, we've been rescued. If we're a Christian, we are saved. But there's still more battles to be fought. There are still more territories to be won. There are still more blessings to be and victories to be brought in. There are tantalizing prospects ahead. And so for us, the best is yet to come. Someone said that the only fully saved Christian is a dead one. Now that's right. The only fully saved Christian is a dead one. It's not over until it's over. And so we enter here, verse 6, where Caleb, he's 85, and his 85-year-old men are wanting to do. He tells his story to a group of younger men. That 45 years ago, Moses sent him out on a mission. So let's look at the chapter this evening, and we'll probably notice three things in the passage. The first thing we notice here is that faith gets crushed. Faith gets crushed. Do you see the verse 7 there? He says, Moses sent me in to explore the promised land. I brought back a report according to my convictions. Look at verse 8. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. Faith gets crushed. Caleb sees opportunity. Caleb sees the land of Canaan. It's a land flowing with milk and honey. You can read about it in Numbers chapter 13. Remember there he talks about the huge clusters of grapes. He says it was a land flowing with milk and honey. But yeah, there were fortified cities there, and the descendants of Anak were big guys. They were really, really hefty. They were bruisers. But Caleb says, no. We can possess this land. We can do it. But others said, we can't attack. It's like Private Fraser, isn't it? And Dad's Army, doomed. We're all doomed. Why is it the script writer put an old Scotsman in as a negative thinker? Eh? That's a racial stereotype if ever I saw one. We're not the Private Fraser type, so are we here tonight? Caleb's friends were. They crushed his faith. He saw this opportunity. He saw the promises of God, that God could certainly do it, that God could do absolutely anything. And notice the interesting thing there. It says, but my brothers who went up made the hearts of the people melt with fear. Misery loves company, doesn't it? And whenever you get a miserable person, whenever you get a critical person, whenever you get a negative person, they never like to be alone. They're always networking it. They're always trying to, you know, tell other people what their misery is. They're always trying to spread it around, evangelizing their negativity, because they don't want to be alone. They want to bring many people down with them. And so a whole chain of grumbling was set off. And it's easy to pull things down. It's easy to pull things right down to the ground. I reckon if I had a sledgehammer and a day, I could knock my own, or well, it's not my house, it's your house. I could knock the man's down. No, that'd be a great insurance claim for the Deacon's Court. minister went crazy one day and with a sledgehammer. I could do it. I couldn't build a garden shed, though. It's easier to pull something down than to build something up. And so that's the problem here. Caleb is full of faith, and he's crushed. The 10 guys have said, it cannot be done. You ever used one of those vacuum packs for going on holiday? You know, for getting things into your suitcase. They're great. You put whatever you've got in a pack, and you get this vacuum thing, and you suck all the air out of it. There are some people who are two-legged vacuum pumps. They suck all the energy and all the air out of our lives. You ever been to churches run by these people? They suck all the energy out of it. And so it's lifeless, it's depressing, it's demoralizing. You just feel that your life has ended. They're what Richard Buse calls the frontliners and the backliners. You've got the people with the faith and the vision. You've got the people who are full of joy in the Holy Ghost. The people who are really reveling in the power of God. And you've got what he calls the backliners. Spectators. People who grumble about triviality. At the end of the day, most grumbling is about trivial things, which at the end of the day do not matter. They are of no eternal consequence whatsoever. And they are sometimes just a matter of personal taste. You can't stand white cars. Your friend across the church can't stand black cars. Get on with it. It doesn't really matter. It's at that level. And so the result is that Caleb and Joshua are crushed in their faith. And because the 10 dominate, and because the 10 network, and because the 10 get their own way, the work of the kingdom is set back 40 years. They're wandering about doing nothing for a full 40 years. Such lives never promise. Such churches led by such people never promise, never prosper also. And you see, all Caleb was doing was this. He says, guys, look at the opposition. The opposition are mere phantoms. There's a great line in Numbers 14:9. He says, do not be afraid of the people of the land, because we will swallow them up. They are as bread to us. We can eat these guys. Caleb was crushed, and he had to stand alone. He had to go against the flow. And folk, that's what God is calling us to do. Faith is a crushing experience. And in your situation, wherever you are, when you are surrounded by negativity, when you're surrounded by people who really don't get it, you've got to go against the flow. You've got to have the courage not to be diverted by the static. You've got to have the courage to follow what God is saying. Remember, only dead fish go with the flow. So, young people, sometimes that's what your Christianity will lead to you in school. You've got to go against the tide of popular opinion. You've got to dare to be different. You've got to be fundamentally, you know, countercultural. And that is a crushing experience. And it's difficult when the opposition is friendly fire. You shouldn't be fighting against the church. There's something wrong when the battles are all against the church. The church is the place where we come to be enthused and energized and built up. The battles are out there, not in here. This is a place of harmony. This is a place of peace. Sundays at Smithton are a place to build us up for the week ahead. We don't want to waste our time in fights. We don't want to waste our time in fighting one another. 2 Timothy 4:16, Paul is telling his young friend, he says, everyone deserted me, but the Lord stood by my side. And so we've got Caleb, he's in that situation, and faith gets crushed. I was reading in Numbers 14:4, and it says this. We have that verse, the people are afraid, and so they want to choose a leader. They want to choose a new leader. Numbers 14:4, it says this, we should choose a leader and go back. Imagine a church choosing a leader who's going to take them back the way. It happens. It happens. I was in a church once when I was a student and it had a great preacher. There was electricity in the air. And the next guy, the leadership, thought, oh, we want a man to take us backwards. The church shriveled and shriveled and almost died. No. We want to appoint leaders not to take us back to Egypt, not to take us back on the journey. The journey is too radical. There is tomorrow. There are generations to come. It's not all about, you know, I'm in my 50s. It's not all about my generation. It's about the generations to come. It's about the possibilities of the future. We're building a church here just not to satisfy the baby boomers. We're building a church here that will serve our community for, I hope, many years to come. But if you have a vision, if you want to move forward in the things of God, there will be this crushing element. Faith gets crushed. But it's not the end of the sermon. There is positivity. Secondly, we notice that faith drives you. Faith drives you. And that's what we have here in the Caleb situation. Look at verse 8. But my brothers who went up with me made the hearts of the people melt with fear. I, however, followed the Lord my God wholeheartedly. What drove him? It was faith. He noticed, he based his life on what God had promised. Look at verse 6, look at verse 10a, verse 10b, 12a, 12b. Five times he says words to the effect of, he says, I am going to obey what God has said, what God has commanded me. Again and again he's saying that. Five times. Now, he saw the same thing as the majority. He saw the Anakites. He saw the fortified cities. He saw the same things, but he just had a different perspective. We live in the same world, the same society. But faith drives. How often are we in conversations that go like this? It's a typical conversation I would have. One of my friends comes to me and says, I've just come back from a great holiday. I hired a Harley Davidson and we went on Route 66. It was awesome. And I would probably say, oh, I was thinking of doing that. Let me translate. I'm saying, oh, I didn't do that. I wouldn't do that. You see what it is? Faith doesn't just talk. Faith doesn't just say, oh, I was going to do that, or I was thinking of doing that this morning. Yeah, this week I was thinking of starting my running regime and building up to doing a 15K. Yeah, I was thinking about that. But 99% of us don't do it. And that's exactly like faith. Caleb had faith that drove him. He acted. And he acted on the word, not on his feelings. He acted on the word. Many of you here today are professionals. How does a professional operate? A professional operates on this basis, that they do their job irrespective of how they feel, irrespective of the circumstances, they simply do it. Irrespective of the clients, the bosses, the patients, whatever, they do a good job for everybody. That is what professionalism is about. And if we operate like that in a so-called secular environment, which is a good way to operate, surely in terms of faith, we should operate not just on our feelings, but on our faith in not a mere human contract, but on the word of God. Think for a moment what faith is. We talk about having more faith. No, that's not what's required. It's not having faith in faith. That's not what we need. It's having a little faith in a great God. So what is required is not so much more faith, but a bigger comprehension of God. A sense of the size of God, the immensity of God, the power of God, the fact that God can do absolutely everything. My God is so big, so strong, and so mighty, there is nothing that my God cannot do. And so we don't see the bigness of the mountain, we see the bigness of God. And you see, the cities of Hebron, they were large and fortified. Yeah, but what were they compared to God? It was a difficult task, but it was the difficulties that stimulated. It was the difficulties that made him excited. I used to do jigsaws. It started with the children with their six-piece jigsaw. I quite liked doing that. It was about my level. And you do the six-piece jigsaw. But you get a bit bored by that. And then you do the 500-piece jigsaw. And it looks really, really good. And you get a bit bored with that. And then you do the 2,000-piece double-sided jigsaw of a can of beans or something like that. Or a plate of beans, and that's a challenging jigsaw. It's the difficulty that drives you on. The difficulty inspires you. And it seems to me, when Caleb saw the hill country of Hebron, it was difficult, but that's the thing that drove him on. That's the difference that inspired him. We had Ranald Fiennes here. He was speaking at an event here during the week. One had hired the facility, and I sneaked in, and it was inspirational hearing Ranald Fiennes' stories of adventure. I remember that night going to a church meeting not connected to this church and contrasting the adventurous spirit of Ranald Fiennes, who just loved to go into difficult tasks, and this particular church that was frankly scared of the unknown. I just noticed it, in fact, here when I was reading the passage earlier. Look at verse 15. Hebron used to be called Kiriath Arba after Arba, who was the greatest man among the Anakites. Hebron was owned by the big guy, the greatest man among the Anakites. And yet, when Caleb saw that God's perspective showed that the greatest man among the Anakites was tiny compared to God. Kennedy Smart, you will not have heard of him. He was one of the founders of the PCA, the Presbyterian Church of America. And he was responsible for MNA Mission for North America. And he tells this story. A shoe company sent a salesman to a foreign country. And the guy cabled them back. And the cable said, where is it here? Send me home. No one here wears shoes. And so the guy went home. So they sent another guy out. And the second guy sent a cable. Send me all the shoes you can make. The market is absolutely unlimited. No one here wears shoes. Now, isn't that so interesting to show the different perspectives? And that's what Caleb says. He possessed the mountain not because he was optimistic. It wasn't anything to do with optimism. He hadn't been to a Tony Robbins conference to, you know, inspire him with positivity. He was optimistic because he believed God. Look at verse 12b. It says there, that expression, now the Lord helping me. The Lord helping me. I will drive him out. But the Lord helping me, I will drive him out, just as he said. Caleb does not view God as his errand boy. He is confident, but he is not cocky. His faith is ventured on a big God, an Anak, the greatest of the big guys, the king of Hebron. Little Caleb threw him out. Yeah, faith gets crushed. But faith drives you. Thirdly, we notice here that faith stays the course. Faith stays the course. He kept referring to his age. Verse 7, I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me. Verse 10, so here I am today, 85 years of age. Isn't that interesting? He stayed the course. The convictions that Caleb had as a young man, and 40 is young, were with him through middle age. He spent middle age in the desert. And among these, that's where, because he'd listened to the majority 10, he wandered in the desert for 40 years, and he kept going. Now at 85, that's old. I think. That is not seriously old these days, but it is old. I would give a seat in a bus to an 85-year-old. Although folk are beginning to give me a place in the bus, which is a little bit worrying. But he stayed the course. Even in these 40 years in the desert, in an age of disgruntlement, in an age of negativity, when folk were saying, oh no, not manna again for breakfast, fed up here. We were walking around, did we not pass that bush yesterday? Is that not the ravine that we saw this morning? We just keep walking around in circles here. He never lost sight of that which was important, even when it was mundane. The church can become ageist. Now, ageism is a bit like racism. It works both ways. You can have the ageism that says that nobody has got an opinion that matters until they are at least 70. Anything under that is not worthy of speaking about. That's one ageism at the top end. The other ageism is at the bottom end, when everything's got to be young and everybody's got to be cool and everything's got to be awesome and beautiful. And when you reach the age of the old age of 40, yesterday's person, you just got to go. It's a young man's world. Caleb's interesting. Consistent, energized through every single stage in life. So I love here about Smith. Every stage of life is represented. what I love here about the service tonight. Good pile of young folk, good pile of middle-aged folk, good pile of older folk. We are here together. It's a very well spread out church in terms of age profile. Now, he's devoted when he's young and he keeps going. Many of us take a dip in middle age, don't we? We get consumed with the family. We get consumed with work. We get consumed with stuff. We get consumed with all that stuff. And you find that many folk just simply bottle it. The focus started off well. They just bottle it. They just lose it. I think of two well-known figures in the church. A.W. Pink. Some of you may have heard of A.W. Pink. He wrote books. He had a very interesting ministry, very encouraging ministry as an evangelist. He was English, he had a ministry in Canada, in the US, he went to Moody Bible Institute. He was one of the pin-up preachers of his day. A.W. Pink ended his life in Stornoway, in the island of Lewis. Not there's anything wrong with that, but in Stornoway, in the island of Lewis, in a house, not going to church, because there was no church good enough. A sad, lonely, bitter old man. Tozer, A.W. Tozer, wrote incredible books about the majesty of God. Tozer ended life bitter, disgruntled, alone. Couldn't stand his family. Couldn't stand people. What happened to these men? We're talking this morning about judging. What went wrong in their lives? What turned them from being positive, energy-driven, faith-driven, Jesus-transmitting men of God to being sullen, negative, and bitter? Do you want to end up like Pink or Tozer? Or do we want to end up like Caleb, 85 years of age? Give me this mountain. The key to the church is not young people. You can't build a church in a children's ministry. You can't build a church in a youth ministry. That's a myth. We all need one another. The young folk need inspiring middle-aged folk to say, when I grow up, I want to be like that person. I want to live like them. I want to walk like them. I want to talk like them. The older folk, just stirring folk on. I had a meeting last week with someone from another church. I was doing a little bit of work with them, and we met down in a hotel downtown in the foyer, and this person was telling me about the plans for their church. The church is just going through a really exciting new phase of its life. And I says, are the older folk a problem? And he said, no. No. It's the young folk that are the problem. It's the folk in their 30s and 40s. He says, I've never seen a more conservative bunch in my life. It's the folk in the 80s and 90s that are saying, let's do this. Let's do this thing. I'm blessed. We are blessed in this church to have a group of older folk who are saying, come on, just get on with the work. Older folk who are saying, this is great. Older folk who are saying, it's not just about us. Older folk who've got a kingdom vision. And so here we have Caleb, 85 years of age and still growing. He's a cheerleader for the next generation. I hope that doesn't sound too cheesy, but it's a great vision for our older folk, cheerleaders for the next generation. But sometimes what happens is that we grow cold and we don't really notice it. You ever had a cup of coffee and you set it down and it just gets, you take it out and it's lukewarm and you've not noticed it. and you chill other folk down. You find yourself, you're middle-aged, and you're in a group of people, and the conversation negative, and you come out and say, oh, that was a bad night. No one's prepared to say, guys, we're not what we once were. No one is prepared to say, guys, we're not the radical young folk who were on fire that we once were. We've grown into just old critics. We're losing our edge. Caleb got to the top and he said, give me this mountain. A climbing instructor some years ago had a group of folk and they were climbing Mont Blanc. And he said, look, the only way we're going to go up this is if you bring, obviously, your gear, but your boots and your ropes. And this comedian turns up with video camera, an ordinary camera, haversack. I think he thought he was out for a day at Ascot with all the food he'd brought. And the leader says, listen, you're not going to make it. I'll make it. And the guy marched on ahead. The group coming behind saw a haversack full of food left behind. And there was a guy climbing. And he was struggling. And then the group came across a camera. And then the folk came across a video camera. To get to the top of the mountain, he had to get rid of all the extraneous stuff. Tonight, God is saying to us, listen, people of faith, let's move on. And corporately, as a group of, I don't know, a couple of hundred folk here tonight, corporately, we are saying, and we're looking at the kingdom opportunities, and we're saying, Lord, give me this mountain. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your word, for its power, for its encouragement, for that great story of Caleb. Lord, the God of Caleb is the God who is with us this evening. The God who gave Hebron to Caleb as the God who is here this evening. Lord, help us to move on in your strength. Bless us. Fill us with encouragement, big visions. Wash away our negativity, our grumbling. May we see the glory and power of God, and may we experience that in our lives. Amen.